session. Please be seated. We will hear argument in the case of Gross Spiegel et al. Versus Maggie Toulouse Oliver, which case is case number 34306, and we are here on a verified petition for writ of superintending control. Before I have counsel state your appearance and we begin argument, I just wanted to explain a few things. The parties have been informed that the court has structured oral argument as follows. We will hear first the argument on the statutory issues for 60 minutes, that giving each side 30 minutes. Then we will have a break for about 15 minutes, and then we will return to hear argument on the constitutional issues for 60 minutes, which gives each side 30 minutes. I want to remind everybody that there is not to be any outbursts, clapping, or other demonstrations in the courtroom. We are making a record for the court, and so we need to be sure that we get all of the arguments on the record. At the conclusion of today's hearing, the court will adjourn to begin our discussions. Because of the seriousness and importance of this case, the court will not make a decision today. We will issue an opinion at a later time. So at this point, I'd like for counsel to state your appearances for the record.
If this court, Daniel Ivy Soto, on behalf of petitioners, and I'm joined with Grace Phillips, on behalf of petitioners.
Your Honor, Evie Gillick, on behalf of the chief former and current legislators, and with me are Mr. Jim Campbell and Mr. Joseph LaRue. Mr. Campbell will be presenting argument for me.
And is Mr. Campbell licensed in Mexico? Is he appearing pro hoc vice?
Pro hoc vice.
Okay.
Yes,
sir. Okay. Thank you. And then?
Scott Fugler, Your Honor, with the Attorney General's Office here on behalf of the respondent. I'll be, as you know, addressing the statutory issue for this morning. Sean Cunniff is also here with our office. He will be addressing the constitutional issues.
Good morning, Your Honor. Maureen Sanders on behalf of the plaintiffs, real parties of interest, and with me at table is Laura Shower Ives and Peter Kearse, and I will be giving vote to the argument.
Thank you. We will go ahead and hear you, and we'll begin for the intervenors petitioners.
Good morning. May it please the court. Sherry Jett is my wife. There are, as of last Friday, 1,466 couples in New Mexico who do not share the same legal certainty we have as to the lawfulness of our marriage. Despite having been issued a marriage license by a county clerk, as was issued to Sherry and I. This court properly accepted this matter through your power of superintending control to resolve questions of the legality of same-sex marriage, to establish a single understanding of the laws of marriage applicable throughout the state, and to instruct county clerks as to their lawful duty when an otherwise qualified same-sex couple appears to apply for a marriage license. In the 16 days between August 21st and September 6th, 8 county clerks were sued over the same essential question that was posited in the Bernalillo County case filed earlier that year. And there were 18 additional lawsuits promised or threatened at that time. Today, mandamus directing the issuance of marriage licenses to same-sex couples has been issued against 4 county clerks and is pending against a 5th. Action has been filed against 3 other county clerks seeking to prohibit them from issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. The final declaratory judgment, which gave rise to today's hearing, immediately directs 2 county clerks to issue licenses to otherwise qualified same-sex couples. So since this court agreed to hear this case, no additional lawsuits have been filed, and all pending actions have been stayed. Ideally, the legislature would clarify that. However, proposals to authorize and prohibit same-sex marriage have failed over the last decade. Even if the legislature clarified the law, that does little for the 1,466 couples who already have licenses. It is the responsibility of the legislature to define what the law will be, but it is the responsibility of the courts to define what the law is. Thank you very much.
morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is James Campbell on behalf of the MVP legislators. There are at least four reasons why this court should conclude that New Mexico's marriage statutes do not currently permit marriage between two people of the same sex. First, the plain meaning of Section 40-1-1, as it was understood at the time it was enacted, contemplates marriage as an opposite-sex union. Second, construing comprehensively and in harmony all the statutes pertaining to marriage confirms that marriage in this state is the union of husband and wife. Third, this court has previously given indications that it understands marriage in this state to be the union of a man and a woman. And finally, if we look to other jurisdictions, every other state high court that has construed a similar set of marriage statutes has concluded that those statutes do not permit marriage between two people of the same sex.
Is there any state that has statutes like ours that are as vague as ours?
I believe there were at the time that those courts construed those statutes, and I believe I would point this court to four high court decisions. First, the New York Court of Appeals in the Hernandez case faced a very similar set of statutory laws pertaining to marriage. In addition, the New Jersey Supreme Court in Lewis versus Harris, the Minnesota Supreme Court in Baker versus Nelson, and the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in Goodrich versus Massachusetts. If this court looks at all of those decisions, it will notice two uniform features running through its analysis. One is the court looks to the fact that the marriage statutes were enacted over a century ago, and the courts conclude that at that time it was inconceivable that marriage was anything other than an opposite-sex union, and thus the courts construed those provisions to entail marriage only between one man and one woman. In addition, those courts also looked throughout the statutes and construed them comprehensively and in harmony and came to the conclusion that the provisions using sex-specific language informed the provisions using sex-neutral language and that the scheme as a whole should be interpreted to indicate that marriage in those states was the union of a man and a woman. This court should reach the same conclusion here.
If our statutes prohibit same-gender marriage, why have there been repeated attempts over the years, particularly in the last half dozen years, to introduce legislation by various of your clients to specifically say marriage is between people of opposite sexes, if the statutes are already clear on that?
My clients understand that marriage in this state is the union of a man and a woman, but they introduced those bills for one reason, and that is to prevent what happened in 2004 in Sandoval County, where the county clerk began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, prevent that from happening again.
What should we take from the fact that the legislature refused to adopt those statutes, to enact them?
I think that would be an attempt to glean meaning from legislative silence, which, as this court has mentioned in the past, is at best a tenuous guide to deciphering legislative intent. In addition, under these circumstances, many other legislators have introduced bills seeking to define marriage in this state as the union of any two people. So there's really no possible way to glean any intent one way or another because there have been bills introduced on both sides.
Sounds to me like the very definition of ambiguity. Neither side can quite discern what the statute means.
I don't think it's ambiguity for this court's analysis. I think that the legislators were trying to bring clarity for government officials to know whether they could issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples or not. But when this court engages in a proper judicial construction, the marriage statutes viewed comprehensively and in conclusion that marriage in this state is the union of a man and a woman.
Were people able to get married before civil governments started creating marriage licenses?
Marriage has long predated the government.
Right. Yes. And so when civil governments started enacting legislation, did they expand or restrict the rights of marriage?
I think that they recognized the rights of marriage that existed at the time. And they recognized that the government had a direct interest in the marital relationship of men and women throughout the state.
Our statutes have specific restrictions against incest, for example. and don't have any restrictions relating to gender. Should we read anything into that?
I don't believe this court should, and let me explain why. The specific provision that you're referring to is Section 40-1-9, which lists the prohibited marriages in this state. At the time that provision was enacted, no one in no jurisdiction contemplated marriage between two people of the same sex. So there was no need for the legislature to clarify whether that would be a marriage here. In contrast, incestuous marriages, some close familial marriages, as well as marriages between teenagers were recognized in some jurisdictions and were understood to be marriage by many people. So it was necessary for the legislature to clarify at that time that those unions were not marriages.
Was it a clarification or a new restriction?
Well, I think in light of the common law, we would have to look to see what the common law at that time recognized. And I'm not 100% sure what the common law recognized in terms of incestuous and teenager marriages. So I'm not sure whether it was a restriction or not. But it was a recognition that in this state, those marriages, which were considered marriages elsewhere, would not be recognized.
What is your research into the legislation indicated the reason the government got in the business of marriage?
Well, the government has a significant interest in marriage for one primary reason. The government has an interest in channeling naturally procreative relationships into committed unions.
What statute did you rely on to express their opinion?
There are no statutes here in New Mexico that explain the purpose of marriage, nor are there any judicial opinions explaining that purpose.
But there's an express purpose why the application for marriage is required. Isn't that right?
There is a purpose for why the application.
And that's purely demographics and epidemiological studies.
For the license, that is correct.
It has nothing to do with defining who actually is qualified to be married.
For the provision that you're referring to, that is correct. However, I would say that the reason why the government recognized marriage in the first place was far beyond that one statement. That the reason why the government got involved in recognizing marriage was because it had a profound interest in channeling naturally procreative relationships into committed unions so that if children were born, it was more likely that they would be raised by their own mother and father.
Can you point to any place in the statutes where fertility was a condition of marriage?
No, Your Honor, we cannot, but I can point you to a number of things. I can point you first and foremost to 9 decisions that we cited in our brief around the country indicating that this
is... We're talking about New Mexico legislation.
I understand that, Your Honor, but there isn't a clear statement from the legislature about why they first got involved in recognizing marriage in the first place. So this court needs to look.
Your brief is replete with reference to this being the purpose, if not the exclusive purpose, of marriage statutes. That's encouraging procreation. And yet you do concede, don't you, that there is absolutely not word one in our statutes relating to that subject.
I would concede that, but I would also emphasize that this court needs to look beyond just what the statutes say. Many marriage statutes throughout the country don't say what the purpose is.
What do we look to?
We look to other judicial decisions that have considered this question, and we've cited at least 9 of them that have recognized that purpose. We also look to what the Supreme Court has said in the past, the U.S. Supreme Court has said about marriage, and how it's talked about that right as fundamental to our very existence and survival. That is a reference.
That includes the U.S. versus Windsor case that the United States Supreme Court decided just a few months ago.
That does not include that case, Your Honor, but in that case, it wasn't dealing with a state marriage law. It was dealing with a federal marriage law, a very novel and unprecedented measure, where for the first time, the federal government got involved.
Let me ask you about this theory of yours that the overriding purpose of governments regulating and recording marriages has to do with encouraging certain kinds of procreative relationships. If you look at all the statutes in New Mexico that relate to the benefits that are afforded by law to married couples, most of those have nothing to do with whether or not you have children. Isn't that so?
I would respectfully disagree and say when you read them all in contrast, they are all driving towards the government's overriding interest in responsible procreation and child rearing. And
if you get to file a joint tax return as married couples, whether or not you have children.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But you can't do it as part of the same gender family.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Inheritance rights. A spouse can inherit regardless of whether or not they have children. There are statutory rights on that, correct?
That's correct.
Ownership of homes, all kinds of things that aren't pegged to whether or not they have children.
All of those rights further the government's interest in responsible procreation and child rearing because they're intended to incentivize the marital institution and thereby encourage opposite sex couples in naturally procreative relationships to stay together so that if they have children, they're more likely to.
How does allowing committed couples in same gender relationships prohibit or discourage heterosexual couples from getting married and having their children in marriage?
As we've indicated in our brief, this court's equal protection analysis need not consider whether including same-sex couples within marriage would create any harm.
So it doesn't?
We're not conceding that. But my point is that the rational basis and the equal protection analysis requires this court to ask whether including same-sex couples within marriage would promote the same interests that including opposite-sex couples.
Can you articulate any reason why preventing same-gender couples from formalizing their relationship through marriage with the various benefits would discourage heterosexual couples from getting married before having their children?
We have explained in our brief a few concerns, rational concerns, that some legislators have about redefining marriage. And in particular, we have cited a report and a statement by over 70 scholars, including in particular professors such as Marianne Glendon from Harvard Law School and Professor Amy Wax from Penn Law School, stating that when you redefine marriage from a gendered to a genderless institution, you undermine the idea that children need a mother and a father and that there's something uniquely...
Can you explain that in straightforward terms?
Sure. When right now, the union of a man and a woman is what marriage is in the state, according to our argument. And that has an inherent tie to procreation because those unions, unlike same-sex unions, have an inherent ability to naturally create children. So that's the first prong. By redefining marriage to be a genderless institution, there is no longer an inherent link between procreation and marriage. Once that link is severed, less and less opposite-sex couples will see a need to enter into marriage if they're raising children. And
why do you say that? Can you explain why allowing same-gender couples to have the benefits of marriage that we provide, all these financial and governmental benefits and societal benefits, how that would discourage opposite-gender couples from getting married? You still haven't articulated why that would stop someone. Someone saying, I don't want to get married to you because same-gender couples can also get married. How would that ever come about?
That's not the concern at all, Your Honor. It's the redefining of the institution itself. It's if the institution has nothing to do, no inherent connection with procreation anymore, then opposite-sex couples will come to see less and less of a need to
enter
into it.
Even though they can get community property benefits, they can get all the inheritance benefits, they can get all these things that you say are provided as an incentive for heterosexuals to get married.
Yes, but over time there's a rational concern that they will see less of a need to enter into the institution.
Mr. Campbell, hasn't the legislature specifically rejected the marriage as procreation argument? In section 40-1-16, they make it very clear. They expressly state that a child born to unwed parents shall have the same rights as a child born to married parents. So they've specifically rejected this marriage as procreation argument, haven't they?
I don't believe they have, Your Honor.
What's the purpose of that section?
Well, the purpose of that section is looking at it from the perspective of the child, and it's protecting the interests of the child. In contrast, the purpose of marriage is to channel naturally procreative relationships so that if a child is born, it's more likely that the child will be raised by his or her own mother and father in a stable family unit. So that is...
So it's really the coercive power of the government that provides the stability. That's your argument, right?
it certainly adds to the stability and of so the relationship.
If the government affords the same benefits to same-gender couples as they do to opposite-gender couples, and the same-gender couple choose to procreate, then the child is the beneficiary. Isn't that correct?
I'm not sure that I followed the question, Your Honor, but if I did, I will try my best to answer it. There is the government's interest in responsible procreation and child rearing is not implicated by the same-sex couple. And the reason why is whenever a same-sex couple brings a child into their relationship, they do so as a matter of intentionally involving a third party, and thus they show a commitment to bringing that child in.
There's a lot more planning and expense involved when a same-gender couple chooses to procreate.
That's correct.
They cannot accidentally.
That's correct.
Procreate.
And the government has a different interest in those two relationships because one can accidentally or unintentionally procreate and the other cannot. I see that my time is up.
Just a second, we want to have one more question.
May I ask you again, getting back to Justice Daniels' question about how same-sex marriages would adversely impact opposite gender marriages. Do you have any empirical data that would support your contention that it's likely to have an adverse impact on opposite gender marriages?
The first thing I would emphasize is that the redefinition of marriage is a novel social development. So there's no way to know for sure what the impact would be. These are all rational concerns, but it's very difficult.
Rational concerns by way of what data or what studies, if any?
Well, first and foremost, rational concerns based on just philosophers, legal scholars looking at this issue and extrapolating on what might happen. But if this court is looking for data, I would direct the court to some data out of the Netherlands before and after they redefined marriage. So for the 6 years before marriage was redefined in the Netherlands, the marriage rate was actually slightly inclining. For the 7 years after it was redefined, the marriage rate turned and started to decline. Similarly, during that, if you look at those same two periods, during the 6 years before marriage was redefined, there was a incline in out-of-wedlock birth and out-of-wedlock child rearing, but that incline picked up after marriage was redefined. Is there any way to prove causation? There is no way to prove causation, but it does support the rational concerns that some people have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Scott Foucault with the Attorney General's Office here on behalf of Respondent. I don't think there's really much question that the statutes in New Mexico governing the marital relationship leave some questions that need to be answered by the court. What rights do they confer, and on whom do they confer those rights? There are, I think, a couple of different ways that the court can approach this. The approach that the petitioners, or the amici, have taken is to read the statutes, at least as they're found in Chapter 40, as a whole. What do they indicate to you as a whole, given that some of the statutes are gender-specific, some of the statutes are gender-neutral? Of course, what it is that Judge Malott determined below in this proceeding was that the statute governing the issuance of a marriage license, 40-1-1, does not discuss the gender of the applicants for a marriage license.
Do you think that the fact that it's gender-neutral was an intentional effort on the part of the legislature to embrace same-sex marriage, or is it simply that it's gender-neutral because, for the most part, our statutes attempt to be gender-neutral in other areas?
Actually, Justice Fehill, I think it's probably gender-neutral because at the time that it was crafted, nobody thought that it was necessary to be either gender-neutral or gender-specific.
So it wasn't as though they were deliberately saying, we want our marriage statutes to embracing same gender marriages.
I think that's right, Justice Veal. I think if that had been the intent, it would have been very easy to either include in that statute or in a different one an express disclaimer that you have to be of the opposite gender in order to be married, which I think that really sort of highlights the problem the court faces in determining what it is our statutes require or prohibit as it concerns the marital relationship and the gender of the parties to that relationship. The statutes aren't clear. There isn't a statute that says yes or no on the question of whether or not same-sex marriage is legal in New Mexico.
Is it fair to say that when the marriage statutes began to be adopted, and over the years, up until recent years, legislators just assumed that people would be of opposite genders?
I think that's exactly right, Justice Daniels.
And at what point does an assumption become part of positive law?
I'm not sure that it ever does.
It was based on the social customs at that time, just as the social custom were that women didn't serve as judges or governors, and that's why we see in those same statutes references to which clergyman could perform a marriage, references to he.
That is correct, Justice Daniels. I think that's exactly right.
And would that mean that women clergy could not perform marriages now simply because everybody assumed back at the time these statutes were written authorizing the he's to conduct marriages,
I think
all clergymen would be men?
That would be a pretty flimsy basis on which to determine that a woman could not solemnize a marriage. I think that's exactly right. I don't think there's any disagreement that there was a background assumption at the time that virtually all of these statutes were passed that marriage was an institution reserved to opposite sex couples. But that assumption, I think you're right to ask, and I think the answer is it does not carry the force of positive law. The question for this court is what do the statutes say, and how do we interpret those statutes to be in harmony with the constitutional
Statute is at issue in this case? That's never been clear.
That's a difficult question to grapple with, actually, Justice Chavez.
Yeah, because if we deal with this simple statute of gender-neutral provision, and let's say that we agree that it's ambiguous and therefore it doesn't govern and it doesn't specifically prohibit same-gender marriages, how does that affect all of the gender-specific statutes, the ones that confer the benefits and the responsibilities?
I think that is the question, Justice Chavez, because I think it would be a correct decision for this court to say 40-1-1 on its face does not require the applicants to a marriage license to be of the opposite sex. Therefore, same-sex couples can get a marriage license. But as your question points out, that isn't even almost the end of the inquiry, because there are sort of a complicated web of statutes and regulations in New Mexico that touch somehow on the marital relationship and define in some way the contours of the rights enjoyed by the parties to that relationship. Just in Chapter 40 itself, in the research that we conducted, found several provisions, 15 to be exact, in the first four titles of Chapter 40, that are gender-specific. And several of those describe very particularly the rights of the parties to a marriage. I think the best example is community property.
Of course, if we just focus on 40-1-1 and hold that it does not specifically preclude the same-gender marriages, then the debate can continue. The legislature can talk about all the policy reasons for or against past legislation or not. And if they do pass legislation, we'll be right back here talking about the Constitution.
What I was going to say, Justice Chavez, with all due respect, I think that would be punting.
Yes.
To only determine the question on the basis of the language of 40-1-1, because there are so many other questions raised by so many other statutes about what rights a same-sex couple that obtained a marriage license pursuant to 40-1-1 would be able to enjoy. And, of course, I know that the second portion of the argument, as the Court has delineated, it will discuss the constitutionality of those provisions. But to get back to your original question, Justice Chavez, I unfortunately cannot give you a comprehensive list of the statutes in New Mexico that touch on the marital relationship. To put it in context, there was a bill introduced into the legislature a couple of years ago that would have done this, that would have amended every provision in New Mexico law that deals with the marital relationship that uses gender-specific terminology to make it gender-neutral. The bill was 900 pages long. I would not pretend, certainly not in the 20 minutes that I've been allotted, to be able to identify for you every one of those statutes, even if I had the bill in front of me.
And, of course, the legislators were also attempting to do a domestic partners.
That's correct. I appreciate that clarification. I don't mean to insinuate, and I suppose I sort of did the way that I phrased that the entire 900 pages of the bill dealt with making gender-specific terminology gender-neutral in those provisions. But I think the overall point remains. We're talking about a myriad of statutes. And I think the easiest...
And yet what we've seen in other states, California, New Jersey as an example, when the legislators have dealt with the civil union or domestic partners versus marriage, the constitutional issue always surfaces.
This was a point that I was hoping to make. I don't think there's any way that the court can determine the question before it about whether or not New Mexico permits same-sex marriage without some reference to the constitutional provisions that lie in the background here, because I think the principal statutory construction canon that the court would be applying is the attempt to construe statutes in such a way that they would not be unconstitutional. And of course, you can't do that without determining why it would be unconstitutional to construe it differently. So I think at the end of the day, there's no way for the court.
Well, we did it in Pangea, right?
Well, kind of. I think that's right. But I don't think here. That really resolves the question. I don't think, for example, that the court could read those provisions that use the phrase husband and wife in Chapter 40 to say, well, we're going to read husband and wife to just mean partners, because otherwise it would potentially constitutional question. And I think the reason the court can't do that is because that language is so specific. I don't think there's any way to read husband and wife to mean anything other than husband and wife without finding some reason that it would be impermissible, i.e. unconstitutional, to read it as husband.
Could I ask you some questions about that husband and wife reference in the statutes?
Of course.
And if you've reviewed all these statutes where it's used, maybe you're a step ahead of me. I've done a good bit of research on this.
Don't assume too much, Justice Stamos.
As I look back over the history of New Mexico statutes, at one time, there were serious distinctions between the rights of husband and wife. The Marriage Act of 1862, for example, said that the husband gets to decide where the wife will live, and if she fails to obey him, he can go to court and enforce the right. And various other distinctions. A 1915 statute said that the husband has the exclusive right to decide what to do with the community property belonging to both of them. As I read the statutes, it appears that all those distinctions in rights, between rights of husbands and wives, have disappeared, and now they have equal rights. Am I correct in that, or are there still discriminations between husband and wife in our statutes?
Justice Daniels, you give yourself too little credit. You're way ahead of me. But I think you're right. I think you're exactly right. That certainly there's nothing on the face of the statutes anywhere in Chapter 40 that would indicate any of the kinds of unequal treatment between the male and female members to that relationship that existed in the past. There's nothing like that in the
statute. So it's no longer relevant whether one is the male partner or the female partner the way it once was when you had different rights depending on whether you were born a man or born a woman and entered into marriage.
I think that's right. It is certainly not relevant to determining what rights the members of that relationship have. That's correct.
Okay.
And I think that points up an obvious problem, which is, so why is it that the statutes continue to refer to husband and wife? And in the context of the issues before the court now, the question is the fact that those statutes continue to describe the relationship between husband and wife, does that mean that those rights encapsulated in those statutes would not inure to the benefit of a same-sex couple? And that, like I said, is really where the rubber meets the road on this. Because when you're looking at the institution of marriage, I don't want to wade into the kind of argument that Amiki are making about the purpose of marriage, but certainly from a legal standpoint, the only reason to have marriage from a legal standpoint is because of the rights that go along with that relationship. That's the only reason to legally recognize it.
So most of them relate to financial and property rights, don't they?
Virtually all of them do. Some of them, you know, deal with just the day-to-day affairs of the couple, but yes, most of them are financial and property rights.
And the rights of children don't depend on whether their parents are married or not.
They don't depend at all on the marital status of the parents. The rights of the children are entirely independent of that status. But to get back to something that Justice is discussing, and if I could focus the court's attention on what at least respondent believes is the most appropriate outcome. I think it would be very difficult for the court to craft a decision that identified the specificity of all of the provisions in New Mexico that somehow touched on the marital relationship in such a way that it defined the rights of the parties to that relationship. But I don't think it's hard at all for the court to craft an opinion that outlines the constitutional underpinnings of a declaration that denying those rights to same-sex couples would be unconstitutional.
You're asking us to make a constitutional finding, not a statutory finding, based on the fact that a contrary interpretation might be unconstitutional. Do you understand the distinction?
I'm not sure that I do, Justice Daniels.
Are you asking us to decide the constitutional question directly or to interpret the statute in a way that avoids striking it down as unconstitutional?
I don't think the court can avoid the former. I don't think the court can avoid answering the constitutional question directly. And the reason that I believe that is because I think there are statutes that on their face would prevent same-sex couples from enjoying the same legal rights of their marriage that opposite-sex couples would be able to enjoy. And I think that very clearly and very starkly presents to the court the equal protection issue that you'll be discussing later this morning.
Which statutes are those?
Well, in the brief that we filed on behalf of Judge Millett, we've identified 15 statutes in Chapter 40 that specifically use the phrase husband and wife. 14 of them are statutes that touch on the rights of the marital relationship. And I'm sorry, I said husband and wife. They use gender-specific terms. The 15th statute is the one that prohibits incestuous marriages. The 14 that do use the phrase husband and wife are the ones that touch on the marital relationship.
Right, but do they create different rights between husband and wife?
They don't create different rights between husband and wife, but they would create different rights between an opposite-sex couple and a same-sex couple, because, of course, a same-sex couple would not be husband and wife. And the application of that phrase to a same-sex couple would really be to read that language out of the statute. I don't think that that's the appropriate approach. I think the appropriate approach would be for the court to determine that gender-specific language is unconstitutional because it confers rights on one group and not another, despite the fact that they're similarly situated. I don't, however, want to bleed into the argument that you'll be considering later in the morning. I only mention that because I do think that that's the way that the court needs to resolve the question. And so the response to your question, Justice Daniels, I certainly could give you right now those provisions in Chapter 40 that use the phrase husband and wife to define the rights of the marital relationship, but they're also identified in the briefing. And I think the most, well, people, I suppose, could disagree with this, but one of the most important rights is the community property protection, and that statute uses the phrase husband and wife.
Well, it's husband and wife, but it basically says they both have equal rights, both marriage participants, correct?
That's correct.
There's no distinction these days between the rights of one partner and the rights of the other partner, as we once had.
That is correct. That distinction is absent in the statutes, as they are. The only distinction that exists now is between an opposite-sex couple and a same-sex couple. And some of those statutes on their face would reserve the rights of marriage.
Well, it's a couple who chooses to be subjected to the laws of the state of New Mexico. You have plenty of cohabiting couples.
That's certainly true.
They do not benefit from the community property laws.
That's true, Justice Chavez. And it, certainly a couple that doesn't. If you've got two people in a relationship that don't want community property because one of them may not consider it to be a protection, they certainly don't have to get married, but if that's something that the couples want, they should be able to have it, whether they're opposite sex or same sex. I mean, and that is exactly the kind of thing that I think this case really comes down to. I think that's what this is really about.
Well, as I read the real party and interest petition to the district court, they wanted not only the label of marriage, but also the benefits and protections of the law.
I think that's what the law demands. I think that's exactly right.
The law in terms of the Constitution, but you take a different position with respect to the statute.
That is correct, Justice Vigil. In a nutshell, the position that we're putting before the court is that our statutes in some ways would deny the rights and legal benefits of marriage to same-sex couples, and that in so doing, they violate the Equal Protection Clause of the New Mexico Constitution.
And do you share the legislators' view that somehow our statute should be read to provide that tradition or morality should be read into the meaning of the terms, that the legislature somehow intended that in its current statutory scheme?
No, Justice Vigil, but I will say I don't think that it really matters too much because we're in sort of an odd position here where the two parties don't really disagree too much about whether or not the same the statutes in New Mexico, without any discretion or without any control, permit same-sex marriage. Nobody's taking that position because that position is not supportable under the statutes. Well, like I said, directly, no. We don't share that view. But in terms of determining whether or not the New Mexico Constitution requires same-sex couples to be given the same benefits of marriage as opposite-sex couples, I don't think it matters, frankly, whether you decide that as a whole our statutory scheme governing marriage does not contemplate same-sex marriage, or whether you decide that there are specific provisions that would violate the Equal Protection Clause because they would, on their face, give different rights to similarly situated couples. Either way, I think the outcome is a determination that those statutes are unconstitutional.
You say the parties don't disagree, but the society as a whole disagrees, and there are people in the courtroom arguing who disagree with your position on that, correct?
That is absolutely right, true.
That's why we granted a voice to the amicus interests here, because they represent an important view in our society and our government.
That is correct. Yes, and I welcome the airing of that view for the court's consideration.
Do we have the same problems if we were to put this issue on the ballot, if the same-sex community would get enough signatures to get it on the ballot?
Do we
have to be back here again dealing with the constitutional issues?
I think it would. The answer to that question, Justice Myers, depends on what kind of initiative gets on the ballot. If it's a legislative initiative, that doesn't do away with the constitutional questions. If it were to amend the Constitution in some way, I honestly don't know how that could be done. To amend the Constitution in such a way that Article 2, Section 18 would not apply to the discrimination against same-sex couples, then I suppose if it's possible to craft a constitutional provision like that, that potentially could resolve the question without the court's determination. But the direct answer to your question is it depends on what kind of initiative it was, I think.
Right, because legislators themselves cannot enact unconstitutional laws, correct?
That's correct.
And voters themselves cannot amend a state constitution that would violate the federal constitution.
That also is true. And I think one way or another, a ballot initiative would still require some determination from this court as to whether or not what that initiative did was constitutional, either, as you point out, Justice Chavez, under the New Mexico or United States Constitution.
And in the meantime, everybody on both sides is crying out for an answer without waiting for that to take place. There has to be a status quo that is determined, correct, what the legality is today.
That's correct. That's correct. The parties and the people of New Mexico need that answer. I think this is the second time that I've finished my argument before the court without using all of the time allotted. I've only got 12 seconds left, and in that time, I would say thank you. thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Maureen Sanders, and I represent six same-sex couples who brought the underlying action in Bernalillo County back in March of this year. And in bringing that action, they sought to vindicate their constitutional rights under the New Mexico Constitution. And in that underlying action, they sought two things from the court. First was the issuance of marriage licenses to them. In other words, an order from the court that the clerks had to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Secondly, they requested that the marriages resulting from the issuance of those licenses be treated equally with all other marriages in New Mexico. Today is a historic moment in the history of New Mexico, because today this court is given the opportunity to give credence to the notion of equality of the under the law is what New Mexico is about. It's an opportunity for the court to protect important civil rights previously denied to many individuals in this state. Plaintiffs asked this court to declare that the New Mexico Constitution requires that same-sex couples have an equal right to marriage as all opposite-sex couples. The court can then bring certainty to the existing uncertainty in this state and affirm the principle that all people are equal under the law.
Ms. Sanders?
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand the importance of our decision in this case, What I'm curious about is the procedural part of the case in terms of what was presented to Judge Malott below and whether there was a sufficient factual and evidentiary basis upon which we must then measure under superintending control whether the analysis was thorough and so forth. I believe that before Judge Malott, there were facts that were agreed to, stipulated facts. Can you tell me why the parties below did not offer much of the evidence that we have been presented through the amicus briefs, through your briefs, some of the data that would enable us to more fully measure those factors that are going to be important in our equal protection analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor is correct that there really wasn't an evidentiary hearing below. But the reason that there wasn't an evidentiary hearing below is because the evidentiary hearing would have been related to the constitutional questions presented in the lower court. And those constitutional questions would have been looking at what were the rights involved and what were the classifications provided by banning same-sex couples from marrying, and finally what the relationship between the classification and the justification was. In the courts below, there was no party, no defendant who could proffer a basis, a governmental interest that they thought would justify the discrimination of not allowing same-sex couples from marrying. And so ultimately, Judge Malott entered a final order, a final judgment, declaring that the New Mexico Constitution required that same-sex couples be allowed to marry, because there was an absence of a governmental interest. Now, amici have provided to the court what they believe to be governmental interests that need to be addressed here in the constitutional section particularly. And the Attorney General's memo, which is attached to the petition for writ of superintending control in this court, identifies two governmental interests that have been used in other cases, and the Attorney General's position has been that those aren't sufficient to justify the discrimination. And so, in a sense, we're up here trying to prove a negative in the sense that nobody had any justification.
So is it your position that it's appropriate for the Supreme Court to consider the matters, the underlying data, the empirical data that's been presented to support, for example, whether gays and lesbians are politically vulnerable or should be treated as a suspect or a sensitive class and so forth. So we should consider that information regardless of the fact that the district court did not.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this, because the parties are here on a writ of superintending control, the issue really is one where the court is looking at this as a matter of great public importance. And the petition was submitted to the court by the remaining county clerks who had not been sued in the Bernalillo County action. And it was their need for certainty that prompted the filing of the writ of superintending control. But certainly the court can look at the reasons or the governmental interests proffered by other amici in this case. And in doing so, the court will determine that they do not satisfy the level of scrutiny that is required in this case, which in plaintiff's view is a level of strict scrutiny.
The reality is those facts are what in the appellate business we call legislative facts,
yes,
rather than adjudicative facts that relate to the status of particular parties. They go to overriding questions of legal policy, such as the decision of Brown versus Board of Education, where the court took judicial notice of social impact and so on.
Yes, Your Honor, I would absolutely agree with that, because there were no facts that had to be presented by the parties relating to the individual parties that were involved.
Other than the fact that they wanted to get married to each other.
Yes, Your Honor. And, you know, as this court is well aware, most of the arguments presented to the court today are really questions of a matter of law as opposed to a matter of fact.
Well, let me, why is this a question of constitutional interpretation, which is our responsibility, as opposed to a social policy issue that is the responsibility of the legislature?
Because this court is the guardian of the New Mexico Constitution and the rights guaranteed to all people in New Mexico under that document. And it is this court's responsibility. And denying same-sex couples the right to marry is a violation of the New Mexico Constitution. And it has never been the policy of this court or the United States Supreme Court to allow civil rights and what they will be, what they will contain, sent to the public vote in order to determine whether or not a particular class of individuals have a particular civil rights. It is the job of the courts to decide what is required the government to do under the New Mexico Constitution. With respect to this statute, plaintiffs would encourage that the courts look at the statute with respect to the need for a constitutional interpretation. It is true that 40-1-1 is gender neutral, but there's an entire body of statutory law that is not gender neutral, and the history indicates that the legislators did not suggest that same-sex couples ought to be able to be married. This is the constitutional avoidance that Justice Chavez was talking about. That principle is present here, but it's different than what it was in a Guild case that you mentioned, Your Honor, because here, in the Guild case, there were no other statutes that had to be read in harmony with that particular statute, and it could go, the court could make a decision based on the interpretation of a zoning law. But here, there are an incredible number of rights that accompany the civil contract we call marriage under the law, including not just property and financial rights, but some of the most important health decisions. A spouse automatically has that decision-making authority, for example. But currently, same-sex couples, if they are barred from marrying each other, are not able to make those spousal decisions. And so in
which of those statutes make distinctions in the rights between male participants and female participants in a marriage?
I think most of those types of statutes, Your Honor, actually use the word spouse, and so it would include both the male and the female in terms of
but the ones that you were referring
marriages
to before that referred to a gender in some way, even inferentially through husband and wife terms, do any of those distinguish between the rights that a husband has and a wife has?
I do not think they do any longer, Your Honor.
So a statutory interpretation that says whenever a husband and wife is referred to in a married couple, it would mean either participant in a married couple.
That is certainly an approach the court could take, and it would be certainly a good first step, if you will. But I think that it would result in continuing litigation about does it apply in this case or in that case? Is it only in those situations? I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
What would you do with those statutes if you were to prevail on your constitutional argument here?
If the
you still
court,
have the problem.
There is a similar problem there. But if the court lets the people know that the New Mexico Constitution prohibits a discrimination as to same-sex couples who are wanting to get married or who have gotten married, if there is any discrimination, then that will not be tolerated, much like the court did in NARAL with respect to sex discrimination. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Sandler, let me ask you one last
question.
Yes,
Your Honor.
Did you read the Garcia versus Gentet Court of Appeals opinion?
I can't say that I did off the top of my head, Your Honor, but you can ask me about it.
That's all right.
All right. Thank you.
We'll hear rebuttal from Mr. Campbell and then Mr. Soto.
For rebuttal, I'd like to just point out two principles of statutory construction that we believe requires this court to find that the marriage statutes permit marriage only between a man and a woman. First, this court said in Montoya that a statute must be interpreted as the legislature understood it at the time it was enacted. When the legislature enacted Section 40-1-1, it used the term marriage.
and it is undeniable that at that time it only intended the union of an opposite-sex couple. Secondly, this court said in Rivera that related statutes need to be construed together and in harmony. Here, that would require interpreting all the statutes in Chapter 40 that refer to marriage in a way that makes sense of all of it.
When did the statutes outlaw same-sex marriage? In what year?
Since the beginning.
No, which year did same-sex marriages begin to be unlawful under the statutes?
The Section 40-1-1 was enacted in 1862-1863 session, and at that time, same-sex marriage was not lawful, and it has not been lawful since.
And what language in the statute did that? Because you don't have the recent references to husband and wife and the forms that say male applicant, female applicant. Those are only of recent vintage. So did the legislature make an express decision to prohibit same-gender marriage back then? Or is it something that just didn't occur to them?
It's by not occurring to them and not contemplating same-sex marriage, they did not permit it in enacting 40-1.
Were the statutes creating rights or limiting rights?
The statutes were recognizing marriage for the first time.
People couldn't get married before that?
Not a government-recognized union.
Right. What significance have we attributed to forms in the past? Thinking about election cases, thinking about lease, oil and gas lease agreements.
You're referring to the marriage license applications?
Yes.
Well, in this case, this court should treat it one of two ways, and specifically Section 40-1-18, I believe, is the provision at issue. This court should glean from that statute the fact that there are sex-specific terms. It should glean the fact that the legislature intends marriage in this state to be the union of a man and a woman. Specifically, that statute was put in place in, I believe it was 1961. So at that time, the legislature was confirming once again.
It preceded that the application of marriage certificates have been in existence since the early 1900s. And the marriage certificate has always required a signature from a bride and a signature from the groom, but the application initially was gender neutral. It is now gender specific.
The most recent amendment to that provision, I believe, was 1961. And in amending that provision at the time, the legislature confirmed that they understood.
Is there any indication the legislature consciously addressed the issue of same-gender marriage and made a conscious decision to exclude it at that time?
In one sense, the legislature has been making that decision every year.
Consciously deciding, yes. I mean, in recent years, they've been consciously addressing the issue and haven't been able to come up with anything. Is there any evidence to indicate that they ever consciously faced this issue before?
Not before this issue came up in 2004.
Okay.
But the default.
It's because of the changing cultural mores, the changing customs. That are not the same as they were, the same assumptions that existed earlier, correct?
Well, I would argue to this court then that under those circumstances, the default should be what the understanding was at the time.
How do you repeal an assumption? How do you find an assumption unconstitutional? If you're saying they assumed something but didn't write it into the law.
Well, Your Honor, we don't believe that anything in the marriage laws is unconstitutional, so we don't think that this court needs to find anything unconstitutional.
Let me ask you one other question on your statutory interpretation. You're saying that the legislature wrote these statutes to protect to promote procreation within a marriage licensed relationship. Although there's nothing in the statutes that refers to that. Isn't that really ignoring in this courtroom what we can't ignore is reality in the real world, that the real debate over this is a religious debate, and that the government shouldn't take sides in religious beliefs?
Your Honor, we disagree with the notion that this is a religious debate. At the heart of this question is a question of social policy, and that is what is best for marriage as an institution and how is that going to best serve society?
I understand you're making the argument here, but the real debate in the real world outside here is all based on religion. And you know that.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that because there are, for instance, we cite in our brief a well-known atheist philosopher named Bertrand Russell, who acknowledges this purpose of marriage that we argue to this court. So it is not a religious on one side, anti-religion on the other side. In fact, there are religious groups that sign on to briefs supporting the other side.
That's what I'm pointing to. You have religious beliefs on one side and religious beliefs on the other side. And the religious belief really should be no part of the constitutional decision. Am I correct in that?
You are correct in that. That's why the core question should be a matter of social policy, not to the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take a 15. I'm sorry, Mr. Sotomayor. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, Justices. I do want to parse 40-1-1 just a little bit because I think it's important as we read it, and that is that when 40-1-1 says marriage is contemplated by the law as a civil contract for which the consent of the contracting parties capable of law of contracting is essential, the way that should be read is to insert the word marriage after the word contracting. In other words, capable in law of contracting marriage is essential. Which is to say that I can contract with my sister, but I cannot legally marry my sister. And so when we read this, 40-1-1 is permissive in terms of the marriage contract with those for whom the law permits a person to enter into the marriage contract. And that is an important distinction to recognize with regard to 40-1-1 as this court performs its analysis in this matter. Today in Mexico, there are two status quos, to go into Justice Daniel's comment earlier. In 8 counties, there is the status quo that permits same-sex marriage, while in 25 counties, there is the status quo that does not make that allowance. The county clerks who issue the licenses and the New Mexico Association of Counties who defend lawsuits and have to expend resources to do so seek a single rule from this court regarding this issue statewide. So that they can properly follow the law and exercise their responsibilities.
They're all interpreting the same statute and the same constitution, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there can only be one answer as to what the statute means and what the constitution means.
And that is why we are before this court. Yes, sir.
And you're saying don't wait and defer this to somebody else to decide.
No, that is correct. There is tremendous confusion. You're talking about what happens out there. There's tremendous confusion out there. And we have county clerks who are truly struggling with this issue on a daily basis and wanting to make sure that they are following the law and properly exercising their authority. Thank you.
We will take a break for 15 minutes.